And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Did you hear the president's speech yesterday in Cairo? What'd you think? If you've only read the speech, I've got to say it doesn't do it justice. It's important to sit down and listen to the entire 55 minutes. Though I recognize that it's kind of hard to do that, to find the speech on the web, but I think you can find it, and I think it deserves a listen. It was, by all indications, a masterful speech. President Obama managed in less than an hour to give a full range of concerns airing. American concerns, Muslim concerns, Arab concerns, even to some small extent Israeli, Christian, Jewish concerns. He liberally quoted the Quran. He gave, well, let's just say this. I can give you the entire 55-minute speech in one word. The word is respect. President Barack Obama showed that he respected his audience. And he certainly understood that his audience was not the 3,000 people in a university in Cairo that, like most universities in the Arab world, is not a place of free speech and free learning, but one where political speech is carefully controlled by the government. He wasn't speaking to the people in that room. Oh, to some extent he was, but mostly he was speaking to Muslims all around the world, the great majority of whom are not Arabs. But because Islam came from the Middle East, because it came from Arabia, the Arab homeland, Mecca, Medina, it's always understood that the Middle East is the center of Islamic thought, much as Jerusalem is the center for Jews and Rome is the center for Catholics. Barack Obama showed respect to the Muslim world, and he did so in ways large and small. As I said, he liberally quoted from the Quran without in any way discounting the Bible. He even mentioned the Talmud, the Jewish holy commentary about the Bible. But what he did is he recognized that there are legitimate Arab concerns. First, he made clear that we did not have any desire to occupy any land in Iraq, in Afghanistan, have permanent bases, that we were going to leave. He made that clear. And that's a legitimate concern. Because while we had every reason to go into Afghanistan, and very little reason to go into Iraq, it is clear that whatever our goals there, the goals are not or should not be permanent American occupation. In Afghanistan, Barack Obama made the case very clearly. It was hard for him to make a case for a war in Iraq that he did not support, and I don't blame him. But he reminded the Muslim world, listening to his speech, that 3,000 innocent Americans were murdered on September 11, 2001. He reminded them that the people were innocent. He reminded them that Al-Qaeda took credit for it. These facts, which, as Barack Obama said, are facts and cannot be disputed, are denied by some 40% of those in the Arab world. The Arab world is one where people regularly listen to lies and oftentimes have no idea what's true. What do you expect from a world entirely controlled by dictatorships? In the country where Barack Obama spoke, Egypt, a state that's received more U.S. aid than, well, all of Europe under the Marshall Plan, and certainly more than any dictatorship has ever received in U.S. history. In Egypt, you cannot speak out against the ruler, Mubarak, who's been there for 30 years. Indeed, President Obama's words at the end of the speech, talking about the power to have a say in your government, the power to speak out against your government. Those very words, if uttered by an Egyptian student, would certainly put that student in jail. So he definitely said some things that aren't often said. No wonder the Iranian government made sure to do its best to jam the speech and not let its citizens hear. But he did show respect. And if you listen to, and I really think you should listen, if you haven't heard it yet, to my broadcast on Leslie Marshall's show, which is also posted on my website. Because after the speech, I was all sweetness and light. I was very, very happy. I thought that President Obama had hit a home run, or at least a little more than a triple. Because he both reiterated American concerns and Muslim concerns. He admitted that we overthrew a democratically elected Iranian leader in 1953. You wouldn't think that would matter. It's old news. It's more than 50 years ago, and yet the fact that the American government gave rise to the Shah, a brutal dictator, is often cited in the Arab world as justification for the brutal dictatorship of Iran today, the Islamic brutal dictatorship that overthrew the Shah, the one that is developing nuclear weapons and may, in a decade's time or less, may well be the cause, the catalyst for a worldwide nuclear nightmare. Yes, I know these aren't things that you can normally say on the Head On Radio Network, but I'm not on that network anymore, and I can speak the truth. I do fear Iran. I do fear the fact that they have now apparently developed the technology to do centrifuges for nuclear weapons. I fear them like I fear North Korea. I fear that they will allow terrorist groups like Hezbollah or Hamas to take those weapons and to detonate them over an American city, or more likely an Israeli city. I know the standard response of those that are not very close to Israel. Well, if they murder, say, a million Jews in Jerusalem, then Israel will just bomb Tehran and everything will be fine. No. No, a nuclear exchange of bombs is never fine. And I guarantee you those same people, if Jerusalem were nuked, or more likely Tel Aviv, would be clamoring for Israel not to respond. I guess the optimism I expressed yesterday has been tempered by some sobering thoughts. By listening to the response in the Arab world to what was really a magnanimous speech by Barack Obama, some indeed saw it for what it was, an open hand, a chance for a new beginning, a chance to recognize the suffering that Arabs have undergone, mostly, let's face it, because of their dictatorships, right? I mean, I know it's de rigueur on the left to blame everything on Israel, but if you know the history of the region, and I'm going to talk about it this hour, you know that's kind of hard to do. Israel's made some mistakes, but the West Bank and Gaza, the part that they claim they want, well, was not under Israeli rule from 1948 to 1967, and still, the Arab world was trying to wipe the Jewish state off the map. Throw the Jews into the sea, they called out. Is there any opportunity, any chance for peace in the Middle East? Our president is trying, no doubt, he's trying the best he can. As I said last night, Barack Obama has given the best speech he possibly could. And he's also given, well, he's given matters of policy to the Arabs. The Palestinian leader Abbas has said that he's going to sit back and wait. Wait for Israel to be delivered to him on a silver platter from the United States. He refuses to negotiate. He said this, amazingly, he refuses to negotiate. He only wants unilateral concessions by the Israelis. And yet, when I heard Barack Obama talk about the suffering of Jews, the suffering of Palestinians, putting them on an equal plane, which doesn't quite work, and I'll explain why in a little bit. And then I had a caller yesterday, a caller, Hassan, from Toronto, who said that he is half Palestinian. And he seemed to only hear half of Barack Obama's words. He only heard the part that recognized suffering of Palestinians. He didn't seem to hear anything related to Israelis. And partly that has to do with a mistake that President Obama made, one that I didn't really catch last night, but I'm catching more today. President Obama pretended, or maybe that's the wrong word, chose to emphasize Jewish suffering in the Holocaust as a reason for Israel's existence. And that's a very dangerous thing to do. It's a very common lie told in the Arab world that the Jews are Europeans. They're not even Jewish. They're not even from Judea, the land from which Jews get their name, the land which includes today Jerusalem and the West Bank. No. Judea didn't create the Jews. No. France did. England did. Russia did. And that Europe decided to put its despised, unwanted minority that they'd already murdered in this patch of land brimming with Palestinians to satisfy their guilt. And, hey, it's not our fault. Don't blame us for Hitler. And that the Jews displaced hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, and that's the history. That's not the history. That's not how it happened. But that was the exact words, more or less, used by Hassan when he called in. That is what is taught to their children. And when you have lies taught to children, they often believe them, no matter how wrong they might be. I look at Hitler Youth. It's actually not that hard to teach a lie. And the most fascinating lie that is now commonly taught and even infects my own speech because they use it so often is this lie that somehow there is a Palestinian people. Now, don't get me wrong. Don't get me wrong. There are Arabs in the land of Israel. There are Arabs in Israel. There are Arabs in the West Bank. There are Arabs in Jordan. Jordan, the eastern part of Palestine. And they speak the same language and they have the same culture, and no doubt some of them, many of them, have been mistreated by Jordan, by Egypt, and yes, by Israel. And even more mistreated by their own leaders, by Hamas, by Fatah. So people exist. I don't deny the existence of people, but this weird word Palestinian, where does it come from? It's not an Arab word. I guess it is now, just like, you know, telephone is a word in Arabic and Hebrew now, this American word. Do you know where the name Palestinian comes from? It's a Latin term based on the Romans. You see, the ancient land of Judea, which had been called way even before its conquering by King David, known for the tribe of Judah in the Bible. Again, the territory from which Jews get their names. Many people assume that Judaism is a religion and that Jews get their names from the religion. That's not true. Christians get their names from their religion, Christ being Latin for Messiah or Savior. Islam gets its name, Muslims get their name from their religion, from their name for how they worship God. Jews get their name from the land of Judea, the ancient name for Israel. Just as Arabs get their name from Arabia, The French get their name from France. The English get their name from England. You get the point. Jews have lived in Judea for about 3,500 years. Arabs have lived in Judea for about 1,300 years. Maybe, no, you know, we're about 1,400 years. So they've been there not quite half as long as the Jews, but still a pretty long time, over a millennium. And there are many other peoples that have lived there, Circassians and Greeks and Persians, and for a time, European Christians during the Crusades. But if you know this history, and very few people do, even Jews don't know this history, the Jewish kingdoms revolted against the Roman Empire. They were brutally put down. The Romans destroyed the Jewish temple in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount, which to this day, Arabs deny the temple was there, even though the Western Wall, the Western retaining wall, is still in existence. They destroyed the temple. And they even changed the name of Judea. They called it Philistine, after a Greek people, the Philistines, who were around 1,000 years earlier and fought King David about 1,000 years before the Common Era. That people had long since vanished from the planet. But the Romans didn't want the land to be continued to be called by the name of its people, Jews. So they came up with this name, Philistine, later to be called Palestine. But there's never, ever, 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 did I say ever? I meant ever, been an Arab state with the name Palestine ever in existence at any time in history. Not for a century, not for a decade, not for a year, not for a month, not for a day. So where do we get this idea that Arabs are calling themselves Palestinians? Are they Roman? Are they Latin? No. No, after Rome conquered, and then it was under the Eastern Roman Empire, and it was under there was an Arab invasion. It was conquered by the Arabs for a few hundred years. And it was conquered by the Crusaders for a few hundred years. And then it was conquered by the Turks for a few hundred years. And here we come up to World War I, and the land of Israel, Judea, Palestine, is part of the Ottoman Empire. Call it Ottomania, if you will. Call its inhabitants Ottomans. They certainly didn't call themselves Palestinians. But it was a backwater. Read Mark Twain, The Innocents Abroad, in the late 1880s, and you'll find out that, well, there were not many people there. There were some Jews. Indeed, Jerusalem had more Jews than Christians or Muslims way back at the time of the first Turkish census in 1840. How ironic that now the Arabs want to have Jerusalem. It's understandable. It is in Jewish prayers. It's said every Passover Seder. Do Christians know this? Do Muslims know this? That Jews pray toward Jerusalem? Heck, Christians don't even pray toward Rome. Where do you think the idea of Muslims praying toward Mecca came from? Jews were praying toward Jerusalem, about 1,700 years before Islam existed. The idea of praying toward a holy city, well, like it or not, was a Jewish idea, and the Muslims copied it toward their holy city. In any case, the land was mostly empty in the 19th century. There were Arabs there. Don't get me wrong. There were Jews there, and there were more Arabs than Jews. That's true. Many of the Arabs were wandering Bedouins in and out. There were a few settled cities. When modern Zionism began, modern Zionism did not begin during the Holocaust, my friends. Zionism has existed ever since the Jewish people were exiled from Judea by the Romans. There was always, in every prayer, by every Jew, wherever in the world, this desire to return to Jerusalem, to return to the land of Israel. But modern Zionism dates back to the 19th century. It dates back to the horrific pogroms in Russia and Poland, the same pogroms, by the way, where my own great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents, were mistreated. My great-grandfather, apparently, when the Cossacks came in his village on horseback to shoot all the Jews, which was regularly done, laid in the mud and pretended to be dead. Cossack had a horse step on him. He laid very still, knowing the slightest movement would get himself shot. But this was common. As it says in Jewish liturgy, in every generation they have risen up to destroy us. Some think that Israelis are paranoid, or Jews are paranoid. That may be true. As Menachem Begin once said, even paranoiacs have enemies. But think about it. In every generation, for 4,000 years, someone has tried to murder all the Jews. There's never been a single time in human history where that hasn't been the case. After 4,000 years, do you think that Jews have a right to be paranoid? And all of this predates the Holocaust. In any case, Jews started streaming in to Judea, to the land of Israel, to the Ottoman Empire, right? That's who owned it. The Turks owned it. At that time, they started draining swamps. They started building roads. They founded the modern city of Tel Aviv in 1909. No, not in 1946. In 1909. And Arabs started streaming in because this was the only area of the Middle East that was getting great economic opportunities. The Jews were creating a very nice area. If you read the immigration studies, it's fascinating. More Arabs moved into the land of Israel from the time of the first Zionists coming back from Europe until World War II than Jews. They were, yes, hired by the Jews to build the roads and drain the swamps that the Jews weren't doing themselves. They saw economic opportunity. And in fact, if you look at the migration patterns, you see they came in mostly in lands where there were heavy Jewish concentrations because there wasn't much economic activity in the others. The Arab in-migration was so large that if you talk to Palestinians today, and just ask anyone, ask them where their grandfather's from, then ask them where their great-grandfather's from. While there are families that have existed there for generations, the vast majority of Palestinians didn't. Even Yasser Arafat was born in Cairo. He was an Egyptian. An Egyptian whose family apparently lived in the area for a few years. So we all know what happened next, don't we? The British beat the Turks in World War I. And the British hearkened back to that old Roman name, Palestine. I said there was never, ever an Arab state called Palestine. I stand by that. It's true. Never was. There was a British state called Palestine. It consisted of what is today Israel and the West Bank and Gaza and Jordan and the Golan Heights. And under international law, under the Balfour Declaration and the League of Nations, it was supposed to be a homeland for the Jewish people. You see, there was no independent Arab state anywhere in the area. There was no independent Jewish state anywhere in the area. So the idea was this: Palestine would be given to the Jews, who created, by the way, institutions recognizing the name. The Palestine National Fund was the institution created by the Jews to give money toward the new immigrants. The Palestine Post, which later became the Jerusalem Post, were Jewish institutions. and the Arabs would get Arabia. Indeed, there was an agreement signed by the Sharif of Mecca with Chaim Weizmann, who would later become the first president of Israel, where he gave that tiny spot of land, which is today Israel, Jordan, the West Bank, Gaza, the Golan Heights, because the Arabs would get vastly more territory. Take a look at sometime, look at Israel on a map, and compare its size to the Arab countries that stretch from Morocco in the west to Iraq in the east. If you include all the Muslim nations, it stretches from Morocco in the west to Indonesia in the east. Lands much, much larger than the United States. While Israel's territory is, well, smaller than Vermont. And that includes the West Bank and Gaza. The question in my mind has always been not should there be a Palestinian state. What's a Palestinian? The question is, should the people in the land have the right to self-determination, to decide for themselves? And yes, the Jews should, and yes, the Arabs should. Absolutely. And if the Arabs want to call themselves Palestinians, fine. To that extent, I support a Palestinian state. But let's not fool ourselves. Let's not fool ourselves that there's some distinct people out there, at least, or there was. There may be today, because those kinds of narratives are created and people feel that today. But you won't find anyone calling themselves a Palestinian, any Arab, except to the extent that they meant that they were, I don't know, a citizen of the British Mandate. Does Palestinian mean British? And I guess I'm giving you this history because I'm trying to explain why, well, the narrative that's told today really bugs me. I believe that any people, particularly a people that's been persecuted, should have the right to control its own destiny. I don't like genocide. Never have. And if you look at the Jewish people, I think it's fair to say that unless they have their own state, we will be constantly harassed and murdered as we have for the last 4,000 years. Now, as an American, I can gratefully say that the United States of America is by far the best non-Jewish country to treat Jews ever in history. And yet, even in America, most Americans don't realize how anti-Semitic America was. And that's not even a word I like to use. Let's just say Jew hatred, given that anti-Semitic is a made-up word created by the great anti-Semite Wilhelm Marr, the forerunner of Nazi ideology. Ask me sometime about where that word came from. It's a silly word. Let's just say Jew hatred. Jew hatred used to be rampant in the United States. It's not today. I'm very proud of my country, the fact that it's not today. But in the 1930s, you had radio priests, radio talk show hosts, people like Father Coughlin actively supporting the Nazis, as did folks like Charles Lindbergh, or for that matter, Joe Kennedy. And if you look at a Gallup poll, this is the thing that shocks people. In fact, I've had people not believe me, and then they look it up and like, wow. If you look at the Gallup poll of Americans, in every year from 1939 to 1945, of the greatest danger facing the United States, only in one year, in 1942, right after Pearl Harbor, did they say the Japanese first, the Germans second, and the Jews third. In every other year, in 1939, 1940, 1941, 1943, 1944, 1945, in the midst of the Holocaust, while one out of every three Jewish men, women, and children were being massacred, gassed, babies' heads bashed against the wall solely for being Jewish, the American people, according to that great pollster Gallup, considered Jews the biggest threat to the United States. Do you know one reason why Barack Obama's great uncle, who liberated a small concentration camp, there were many death camps, this was a tiny one, outside of Buchenwald. Do you know why he and his fellow GIs did not expect to find The tens of thousands of corpses, the bodies shoved into, in the case of Buchenwald, it was area meant, stables meant for 50 horses. Horses. 50 horses that had thousands of people stuffed in them. Do you know why they were surprised? One reason they were surprised was because the GIs at the time, in the GI newspaper, one of them tried to publish a story about the Holocaust and was told it was too Semitic. It wasn't allowed to be published. Even while the Holocaust was happening, the great majority of American newspapers referred to it only as victims. Can't say they're Jewish. And Franklin Roosevelt wouldn't say it. And General Eisenhower wouldn't say it. Because they knew that if you told the American public at that time that Jews were being massacred, many Americans would say, hooray. Scary, really. And all before my time. I mean, I know from my own parents and grandparents the Jew hatred that used to exist in America, and I am proud to say that there's very little of it today. Very little. Far less than racism, for example, or homophobia, or anti-Latino sentiment. It's still there, but it's much smaller. The irony is that one of the only reasons that American Jew hatred decreased was because of the creation of the State of Israel. Once Israel existed, once people understood that Jews could have a state like any other people, suddenly the idea that Jews were this demonic, Christ-killing misfits that had to be eradicated, it went away, at least in the Western world. In the Arab world, of course, it grew. In the Arab world, Jews and Christians were dihimi. It's an Arabic word. It means protected people. It really means second-class citizens. They were treated they weren't killed, but they were treated definitely as second-class citizens, much, say, like Jim Crow laws in the United States. And the real problem the Arabs have with Israel is that it exists. This is supposed to be their territory. The Arabs never focused on Jerusalem, ever. Until the Crusaders came, and then they said, oh, it's valuable, we care. Right? They built their mosques on the Dome. The Dome of the Rock was built, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, on the Holy Temple Mount as a way to say, we own this, not the Jews. And Israel, to its credit, has never threatened to tear those buildings down. Muslims have freedom to worship in Israel. Jews, though, were kicked out. Jewish communities, longtime Jewish communities, thousands of years old Jewish communities in places like Babylonia, remember by the waters of Babylon? That's present-day Iraq, were forced out in the 4 or 5 years after Israel was founded, forced out of Iraq, forced out of Iran, forced out of Egypt, forced out of Syria, except for a small portion who were kept there and still today are not free to leave. Jews left Libya. Jews left all these Arab countries. Indeed, the majority of Israelis today are Arab. The majority of Jews in Israel, I should say. The majority of Jews in Israel are Arab Jews. Bet you didn't know that. Even after the Russian immigration, the majority of Jews in Israel are Arab Jews of Arabic heritage or Jewish Arabic heritage, however you want to consider it. And yet, apparently, the Arabs are only somehow considered non-Jews. Muslim and Christians are the only ones that are considered Arabs. Okay. The point of all this history, let's bring it up to the present day. It's always worth retelling. Very few people know it. Is that when Israel became a state in 1948, when England, to its discredit, refused to obey international law, refused to allow the people trying to escape the German death camps from coming, preventing them from coming to the British mandatory state of Palestine. Britain alone probably caused 2 million of the 6 million deaths. America had its share too, refusing to bomb the concentration camps. After Europeans murder all their Jews, now they don't want to support the remainder in Israel. Okay, that's fine. But don't be surprised when Jews in Israel are a little bit paranoid. Barack Obama was right to mention the Holocaust. Was right to mention that more Jews were murdered in the Holocaust than exist in Israel today. But it would have been nice had he mentioned the ancient Jewish history. He's mentioned it in other places. I have no doubt the president knows it and believes it. But I wanted him to tell the Arab world that Jews have a place in Judea, that they have a place in their holy city of Jerusalem. Because I fear that people were doing exactly what Barack Obama said they would do. They were only listening to their side of the story as the Arabs sit back and wait for Israel to be delivered to them on a silver platter. Because let's not forget that repeatedly the two-state solution has been offered and repeatedly it has been rejected by the Arabs. In 1920, Palestine was split, British Palestine, because it's the only Palestine that's ever existed. And the eastern part, east of the Jordan River, 80% of Palestine was given to the Arabs in a country called Transjordan, another country that had never existed before. Transjordan. What kind of friggin' English name is that? Across the Jordan River. Transjordan. All right, we'll make up Transjordan. The West, Palestine. That's for the Jews. Palestine's for the Jews. Transjordan is for the Arabs. That wasn't enough, of course. And then came the other partition in 1947. Well, you know, with 6 million Jews dead, there's not that many Jews left, but at least in the areas to which the United Nations gave to the Jews, they were in a majority in those areas. The Arabs rejected that partition, as you know. And Transjordan invaded the new state of Israel. Got as far as conquering the entire West Bank. That's why they call it the West Bank of the Jordan River. Again, an entity that never existed. It is merely the lines of 1949, the armistice lines, which Transjordan invaded to become the country of Jordan, because they crossed the Jordan River, so they call themselves Jordan. Their people are called Jordanians. It's a new country. They're Arabs, certainly. And they can call themselves Jordanians if they wish. But there's more than a little truth in a notion that Jordan is Palestine. It's all part of an Arab state controlled by Arabs. Egypt conquered Gaza. Again, land that was supposed to be for an Arab state in Palestine, an Arab state next to Israel, and ruled it with an iron fist. You think Israel's been harsh in Gaza? Look at how Abdel Nasser, the dictator of Egypt, ruled Gaza for 19 years, treating it as a prison camp, recognizing that its refugees would love to be in other homes, but keeping them there purposely as a festering sore in the hopes they would rise up against Israel one day, which, of course, did happen. For all the people talking about a Palestinian state, let's never, never, never forget that from 1949 to 1967, all of Gaza, all of the West Bank, and even, yes, Jerusalem, the old city of Jerusalem, the Western Wall, the Temple Mount, the holiest place to Jews, was controlled by Muslims who did not allow Jews to worship at their holiest site. Can you imagine if Christians or Jews took over Mecca and refused to allow Muslims in there? Can you imagine if Christians or Jews took over Mecca and took apart the holy Kaaba, the holy black box in the center of that square in Mecca, and used it for army latrines? Well, that's what Jordan did with a Jewish cemetery that was 2 well, more than 2,000 years old, on the Mount of Olives. You may remember the Mount of Olives. Jesus was there. They took those tombstones and they made them into army latrines. Thousands of years old. And refused to let Jews pray at the Western Wall. If you think that Jews are going to give up the holiest city of Jerusalem for some, glimmer of hope? Then you're living in a dream world. Look, Israel has learned the hard way that whenever it gives up territory, that territory, whenever it gives it up without a peace treaty, that territory is used to attack and to kill. Remember, the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, which, by the way, was an organization formed by Nasser in Egypt with the Egyptian Yasser Arafat leading it. That's probably the first time that Palestinian is ever really used as a word, 1964. Hardly an ancient people. Again, Arabs are ancient people. I don't dispute that. It's this idea that there's a Palestinian people that kind of rankles me because I know people believe that now, and including people who call themselves Palestinians. And they can call themselves whatever they want, I guess. My point is that I see a difference between an ancient people that's constantly persecuted and a subset of a giant people that also wants a state. I'll give you a couple of historical examples. You'll understand what I'm talking about. The Kurdish people is an ancient people. They're in several lands in the Middle East, in northern Iraq, and Syria, and Turkey, Iran. They've been persecuted for centuries. They have a distinct language, distinct culture, distinct religion. I support an independent Kurdistan, and I have for a very long time, ever since I was aware of them. But compare them with, say, the Sudetans. Ever heard of them? The Sudetans were Germans, German-speaking people, living in Czechoslovakia in 1938, and Hitler insisted that they have a separate state. Well, there was a German minority in Czechoslovakia, no question about it. Did they need a separate state? Well, they had Germany, they had Austria. They could have lived as a minority in Czechoslovakia, but Hitler insisted on it. There was a separate state, Sudetenland. It lasted, I don't know, a few months until Germany, having taken all of Czechoslovakia's defenses, came in and invaded the rest. I'll give you another example. Not every example has to involve the Nazis. The country of Latvia. Again, Latvian, an old, historic people. Latvia had trouble after the collapse of the Soviet Union because only about 52% of the people in Latvia were, quote, Latvian, unquote. The other 48% or so were Russian. Now, did the Russians deserve a state? Well, if you talk about them as Russians, it sounds like no. No, the Latvians deserve a state. The Russians can live in a minority in Latvia or they can go back to Russia. Again, if you talk about the Arabs in Judea, they can live as a minority in the land of Israel, in Israel. They can be Israeli Arabs, or they can go back to any of the 23 Arab countries that are double the United States of America. But a new word was created, very cleverly, Palestinian. I'm sure the Russians need to think of this too in Latvia. We'll call them Latva-Russians, I don't know. And then we'll say divide up Latvia, this very small country compared to Russia, into Latvia and Latva-Russia, two peoples, two states. You know, I might even be okay with that. I wouldn't be happy if I were Latvian, but I might even be okay with that if they would stop trying to destroy the rest of Latvia. The same is true for Israel. I think people have a right to control their own destiny. Absolutely. And if there needs to be another Arab state, and they want to call it Palestine, I'm okay with that. But let's not pretend that the Palestinians were there and, you know, the Jews are usurpers. All of this brings me to the question of the settlements. What the heck is a settlement? A settlement, according to, I don't know, Jimmy Carter? Is that where it started? A settlement is any Jew living in Judea, in the land of Israel, outside of the armistice lines when Jordan conquered it in 1949. Okay. You know, of course, there were Jews in Judea, in what is today the West Bank, for thousands of years. Indeed, as I pointed out, in Jerusalem in 1840, and there was only the old city of Jerusalem then, in that old city, which some people today call the West Bank, there were more Jews than there were Christians or Muslims. Don't believe me? Turkish census, 1840. And now some would argue that if a new Jewish home is built in the Jewish quarter of the old city of Jerusalem, that that's somehow expanding a settlement. Well, that's ridiculous. But if you read between the lines, that is what the Arabs are saying. I hope that's not what Barack Obama is saying. I suspect he is carefully being ambiguous here. What President Bush promised Israel at the time that it left Gaza was that the areas of the West Bank that are very close to Israel, suburbs of Jerusalem, within a mile, 10 miles of Tel Aviv. You understand that if the West Bank were entirely Arab, that Israel would be 9 miles wide, don't you? Do you realize how small this area is? Most people don't. 9 miles. That's smaller than the District of Columbia. Wide for an entire nation. Wow. But Bush understood, Clinton understood, even, heck, most Arabs understand that Israel was going to take its settlements, and in return, it was going to even give portions of Israel to the Arabs, because at the end of the day, that's what two states means. It means dividing it into two ethnic boundaries. It means doing unto Israel and the Arab state the same that was done with India and Pakistan, right? These were both nations. India, Pakistan, Bangladesh was all under British India, all of it. And then when India became independent, the Muslims didn't want to live in a majority Hindu area. They had a war, they revolted, and thus became Pakistan and East Pakistan, later Bangladesh. And at that time, some 26 million Hindus were kicked out of the Muslim lands, ethnic cleansing, and some 20 million Muslims were kicked out or pushed out or decided to leave India, and the populations exchanged sides. A very similar thing, of course, happened in 1948, when some 600,000 Arabs left the land that became Israel, some 800,000 Jews left the lands, the Arab lands where they had lived for millennia. Were they forced out? Well, I guess you have to look at each individual case. I'm sure many were. I'm sure many also left of their own accord. But the point is that boundaries are not sacrosanct. The reason why boundaries in Europe are not straight lines is because they're linguistic boundaries between French and Germans and Italians. And the West Bank is an artificial creation caused by armistice lines of 1949. The best way to create a Jewish state and Arab state is to put the areas that are mostly Jewish in the Jewish state and the areas that are mostly Arab in the Arab state. And if there are Jews remaining in the Arab state, they should have equal rights. And if there are Arabs remaining in the Jewish state, they should have equal rights and understand they're a minority. And if Jewish settlements on empty land, and remember, that's what we're talking about here. There's this crazy idea that Jewish settlements are somehow on land where they force out Arabs. That is false, 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 false. That is a complete lie. You will never find a case. I mean, there's Jerusalem. We got that. There's a tiny little settlement in Hebron. Jews have lived in Hebron from the time of Abraham till 1929 when they were all massacred, and they did go back. But everywhere else, it's empty land. All those outposts that you see, it's empty land. Now, I don't support continuing them. I think in terms of making sacrifices for peace, Israel should stop building new outposts on empty land. But so should the Arabs. No one should. Just leave the land empty. Either allow both sides to build or allow neither side to build until there's a peace settlement. Because the dirty little secret that nobody's talking about is in the midst of the Gaza war, when everyone was focused on how Israel was responding to the rockets sent into its cities. And by the way, they seem to have done pretty good. We now know that most of the propaganda was false. We now know that of the 1,400 dead, more than 1,000 were members of the Hamas terrorist group. They were fighters. And yes, the 300 civilians, maybe even 400, though I don't think it was that high. We feel bad about. I do feel bad about. Unfortunately, civilians die in war, though far, far less in the Gaza war than almost any war I know of. But while everyone was focused on that, no one was focused on the fact that Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was offering Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, 98% of the West Bank and even a tiny strip connecting Gaza and the West Bank, a strip of land across Israel. And Abbas refused. No dice. He thinks he can get a better deal. When will Arab leaders learn to take yes for an answer? Whether it was 47 or 67 or Camp David in 2000 or Ehud Olmert in 2008, when will they accept, yes, a Jewish state can exist and an Arab state can exist living side by side in peace? They don't want that. They say they do, but they don't. And how do I know they don't? Because they've refused it time and time and time and time again. So much so that Israel has had to unilaterally withdraw from territory. When the PLO was raining missiles and rockets on Israeli cities in the 1970s, and 5- and 6-year-old children had to run to bomb shelters, and Israel went into Lebanon to get rid of the PLO, by the way, making the Christians of Lebanon very happy because they were also persecuted by the Muslims. Even without a peace agreement, Israel left every square inch of Lebanon, and as soon as they did, Hezbollah attacked sovereign Israeli territory. Israel tried again in Gaza. In Gaza, they removed 5,000 Israelis living in settlements there. You can call them settlements. But there's been a Jewish community in Gaza, too, for thousands of years. But as soon as Israel made Gaza Judenrein, free of Jews, Nazi term, the Gaza residents, who were given a seaport and an airport, who were promised billions of dollars by Europeans, there was no siege of Gaza then, turned around, used their territory to attack Israel. The Israeli people have learned a lesson, and it's a very, very clear one. Every time they give land, they don't get peace. And now people want Israel to give land for peace? Israel is democracy, and at least 2/3 of Israel, and I know, and I've been there, and I've talked to them, and I've seen the polls, at least 2/3 of Israel would give up land if they really, really, really believed they could get peace. They would accept a Palestinian state if they really, really believed they could get peace, but why should they believe that? Every single time they give up land, they get attacked. And if you look through the history, you see that Israel had all of that territory, and they in the Oslo Accords allowed the PLO back in, and the PLO forswore violence and then practiced violence every single year since. Think what would have happened if only Gaza had left Israel alone. If only they'd focused on building their seaport and their airport. If only they hadn't burned down the Israeli synagogues, but maybe converted them to mosques. If only they'd used the greenhouses that make some of the sweetest fruits and vegetables anywhere on the planet, and certainly in Israel, and used them for their own use instead of tunneling arms in there. All I am saying is give peace a chance. So no, I don't think that Israel should trust the words of an Arab leader. They need deeds. And now that the Arabs are sitting waiting for Israel to be delivered on a silver platter, well, they're only listening to half of President Obama's speech. George Bush, Bill Clinton understood about where the lines were going to be. They said Israel could have natural growth within those lines. And I support that. That's where I disagree with Barack Obama. You want to build a house on the road where your mother lives, you can build a house on that road. I don't believe in expanding territory. I don't believe, I think that Israel can have a settlement freeze, which Netanyahu has agreed to, beyond the boundaries, so that they're not taking over new land, but building a house in between two existing houses, I think that's okay. So I think Barack Obama's wrong on that. But at the end of the day, Israel needs a negotiating partner. And it doesn't bother me that, well, it doesn't bother me too much that Barack Obama is basically trying to show that he can get results from Israel. But I'm sick and tired of unilateral concessions. Most Israelis are too. There used to be a vibrant Israeli left. Indeed, the Labor Party, the Israeli left party, ran the state from its founding in 1948 all the way in its first 30 years till 1977. If you want a good socialist paradise, look at the Israeli kibbutz. I know of no more socialist institution, democratic socialist institution in the world. But the left got increasingly disenchanted when every single time they gave a concession to the Arabs used that concession to try to kill more Jews. Now, I don't doubt that there are some Arabs, some Muslims, some Palestinian Arabs, who are willing to let Israel live in peace. I don't know whether the majority or the minority. I fear they're the minority. But I'm getting really tired of a narrative that postulates Israel as the sole aggressor in the region. So while I was very optimistic yesterday, I'm a little more contemplative today. But I'll tell you this, at least I'm free to speak my mind. One of the benefits of no longer being on the Head-On Radio Network, where, let's face it, the hosts are extraordinarily anti-Israel, I'm free to speak my mind. And for that, I'm grateful. On this issue or any other. And if you have a comment on today's show, please leave it on the website at radioinsidescoop.com. And I hope you'll continue to listen. And you know what? If you disagree with me, that's okay too. I never fear disagreement. Call in, let me know. If you think my history is wrong, let me know. One of the things that I found to my dismay when this issue is discussed, like Hassan yesterday in the Leslie Marshall show, is that people who disagree with me just keep trying to talk and talk and talk and talk as if my telling the history is somehow an awful thing that can't be heard. Well, this is the history. And if someone disagrees, they will get their say. But they got to give me my say as well. Hope you enjoyed the show. And I hope you'll leave a comment at radioinsidescoop.com. This is Mark Levine, signing off.